For February the 12th, 2016, we talk about Amazon's new game engine, Darkest Dungeon, and we ask you which speedruns you like to watch. Welcome to Level 138. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm David Meismeth.
And I'm Ben Merkel.
And you're listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. Happy belated birthday, Dennis.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we were not able to have you on last week when it was your actual birthday. But we wish you many happy returns, whatever that means. I hear people say it.
Yeah, that it means there's one fewer of those happy returns left in my life, but thanks for reminding me.
Oh God, mortality.
You can't be getting morose. You're what, like 28?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Just barely 28. Thank you very much.
You can't get insecure about 28. Like,
no, 28 is kind of the perfect age because you still got a fifth of your 20s left. and so 30 seems far enough away, but yet you're kind of through all that, like, college still developing as a human kind of bit. So yeah.
From a scientific perspective, at least to men, 28 is the perfect age. That's at least ideally supposed to be a peak physical development for most men.
It's all downhill from here.
Yeah. Also, that's when most psychological illnesses will have set in. So after 28 and your early 30s, you're in the clear.
Huh. Okay.
It's also mathematically, it's also a perfect number too. So
I don't know what a perfect number is.
It's where the sum of all of its divisors add up to the number itself.
Oh, wow.
Excluding the number
that's
itself.
Better than you.
Can you give me another example of a perfect number?
I think 485, but I'm not 100% sure on that. It might be 495.
Here's the question. Is that of actual mathematical significance, or is it one of those, like, fun parlor tricks?
It's important in cryptography.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's right. RSA, I think you have to generate perfect numbers.
Hmm.
Why?
Well, yeah. are you seriously anxious about turning 30, Dennis?
Oh, no.
Okay, cool. I was going to be like, you don't strike me as the kind of person who would... only unhappy people who don't have, like, you know, the things you have.
I mean, and also compared to my wife, I'm practically a baby.
Oh,
she's a full 6 days older than me. So for a week a year, I am able to just viciously tease her about being old. So that came and went also since we last talked.
That'll be great when she turns 30 too.
Oh yeah, I'm excited for that one.
No, you just have to make it really creepy, like years ago. Oh, gosh, I love dating an older woman. So much more experienced and mature. Just like don't tease her, but just really make it like as unsettling as possible. And the second your ages are the same, it stops.
Yeah, just maximum discomfort. And actually, just cutting it off like that would probably make it as unsettling as possible. So. And then refuse to acknowledge that you remember doing it at all.
Yeah. Just do it until she starts taking like vacations during those 6 days. Like, I just need to. I'm gonna go see my parents.
Yeah.
So what'd you end up doing for your birthday, man?
Well, that gets into the grind a little bit. I went. This is so ridiculous. I had a surprise birthday party. For my actual birthday. But anyway, so I had a surprise birthday party at an arcade called The Place that is literally down the street from me that I had no idea existed. So it was just ridiculous. It was so cool. It was a retro arcade. It's got all these cabinets like signed by the world record holders for that cabinet, for that game. And the owner was really, really cool. Everything is really well maintained. We had a group of probably 20-ish people in the arcade at once, and it wasn't too crowded. And it was just really cool. So I can't believe that I didn't know it existed. and it just kind of was there. So I'm not entirely convinced that Jen didn't build it specifically for the surprise party.
Are you sure there were other people there? This could be some kind of Shining situation. Did you see a picture that you were in from 100 years ago?
Yeah, but I was Pac-Man, and so I was losing all my teeth. This also might have been a dream. I'm not sure.
And you were there, That joke would only have worked if I was at that party, but I was unfortunately unable to make it.
Yeah, I think for good enough reason. But yeah, that's I see us going back there at some point because it's like a hey guys, you need to check this out thing. So
nice.
Hey guys, you need to check this out.
Cool. Well, it's cool that it's that close because that means it's also close to me.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, does anybody else have any banter they want to get out of the way? You know, knock it off. I've got the list open here.
I'm going to save up all my banter for the rest of the show.
Okay.
Banter overdrive.
Well, let us get on to the rest of the show by talking about the things we normally talk about. We have the usual run-up, the brief, the multiplayer, and the grind, which we're going to start with the brief, where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games around us. Does anybody have a story they would like to volunteer to go first?
Yeah, I got one.
All right.
Since I missed last week, I can be first in all things this week. So Rocket League is coming to Xbox One and it's got a release date, which I was not aware until I read this, that was even happening ever at all. So, go figure.
What's the release date?
The release date is February 17th. So not only is it coming, but it's coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
So are you aware, will Xbox One players be able to share servers? Are they entering kind of a common pool of competitors, or is everybody kind of off in their own corner?
That is a really good question, because they do share servers between computer and PS4, I believe. See anything about that in the article that I read.
Okay.
So it would... I could see it either way.
Can you just
right?
ask him real quick?
Yeah.
I mean, I can edit it out.
Microsoft. I'm roommates with Microsoft. I don't know.
They're just crashing there for a second.
It's just John Hodgman. I refuse to not call him Microsoft.
It's really awkward every time you pull out your Mac, though.
Yeah. Like I record on a Mac and he just kind of stares at me with those eyes.
He looks at you like you're Justin Long, by which I mean with contempt.
Good stuff. No, so I could see it going either way. Like mm-hmm. I could see, hey, we work on everything between everything, but I could also see Microsoft and maybe even Sony being really controlling and shitty about it.
Yeah, it seems like they would really benefit from being able to get as many people into the same pool as possible.
One, unlike a lot of games, I'm not sure there would be a disadvantage to, you know, having it. It's not like, say, it's a shooter where, you know, half the people are on mice and half the people are on keyboards.
Right.
So currently with the PS4 and PC crossplay, you can only do private matches with that. You can't do online multiplayer if you have people on both consoles or both systems.
So it might totally be like a walled garden kind of thing. Huh, why can't more games be like Shadowgate or Shadowrun? Sorry.
Shadowgate was the scandal that followed Shadowrun. No,
I don't even know where to begin.
Wait, Shadowrun has multiplayer?
No, Shadowrun, the Xbox 360 game that like it was notable because it had crossplay between the two of them through Windows Live or whatever.
But I remember that it didn't really work.
I understood that it worked, but they hobbled mouse control in order to make it more kind of fair to even the playing field.
Gotcha.
Which is too bad, because that would actually be a game where you could conceivably set it up. You could conceivably set up a, you know, keyboard is for shooting, you know, controllers are for melee.
Where you're just forced to play it, but then you're playing like a different game. That's like the difference between Eve and that Eve console shooter that they were developing. That I'm not sure is still.
Oh, Dust.
The servers just got closed recently.
Oh,
last week or something.
Good for them.
I'm not saying force people. I'm saying the fact that you'll lose will eventually force you. Yep, capitalism.
You can do anything if you don't care about winning.
I'm losing right now. So there was some kind of weird audio glitch where you doubled briefly.
It was terrifying.
Hey, Dennis, you there?
Appropriate. Yeah, there was some kind of glitch where I physically doubled briefly. So that...
Oh my God.
I saw my soul through my own eyes and it was terrifying.
Ooh, you got to start over again.
Oh, wait. Nope. It was a mirror.
Oh, okay. No.
This mirror. Has been a really weird episode already.
let's build this into the fiction where there are just like random tears. That's a time storm.
Yeah.
Who else has a story?
I got one.
Go.
All right. So Amazon, I think today, released that they came out with a new system called Lumberyard, which is a way to make games. It's like a game development engine, and it piggybacks on top of Amazon Web Services and like their cloud system.
Yeah. It's also like paired up with Game Lifter. Like building stuff specifically, like this makes sense because they bought Twitch and now they're building games specifically with like Twitch integration. Like this is the best way to tightly get, you know, build games that are meant for that.
Yeah. And then the game engine itself is free. The multiplayer backend to it, it costs money depending upon how many players you have. And then it's Twitch integrated. So, they at least set up tools so that people could have people on Twitch directly control the game that's being played if they want it. So that kind of opens up a new avenue for gameplay.
Yeah. So have we seen, this is a whole engine for doing games this way. And I know that Tomb Raider had some integration with Twitch where people's posts in the chat room could influence what happened in game. Have any other games done that, or is Tomb Raider the only one?
The only one I've heard of.
Yeah, that's the only one I've heard of as well. Outside of Twitch Plays Pokemon, but
well, okay, yes. Those. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's good that this is being built in like at an infrastructure level. I kind of wonder how soon we're going to see integrations with something like Unity, where they are kind of like building basically selling those avenues into Twitch.
Yeah, so make it like a plugin.
Yeah.
I know. I think something real interesting with this is it sounds like kind of the push for this is that people then use Amazon AWS, or I guess just AWS. Mm-hmm. At least the article I'm seeing is, you know, kind of saying that it's specifically being pitched for multiplayer, which could be kind of interesting because it's sort of seems like something that should have been done for a long time now, but you know, I just assumed it wasn't, you know, financially viable. So I wonder if they've made any changes to how you know their system works, stuff like that, to make that actually something that people might do in the future.
The article that they have, one of the things they mentioned is that it's supposed to make multiplayer easier because a lot of the details of like programming multiplayer is like taken care of by AWS.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting prospect.
Just like the ability to like plug into a shared like EC2 kind of thing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
One, it would also at least potentially take care of like some of the bullshit that EA pulls where, you know, we won't make enough servers for everyone at launch because we know in a couple months most people will quit. Type thing, but you know, if you're just doing an AWS, you can just, you know, go up and down as the game becomes more and less popular.
And you only pay for what you use.
Yeah.
Are we sponsored by them now, guys?
No, we're not.
I expect them to be sending us a check. That's how sponsorships work.
Yeah. No, we just throw it in there and eventually the money will come. You know, you have to do it for the love of the game. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you the story of that off the air. No, this is interesting. It's going to be a couple of years before we see, maybe not a couple of years, but like it won't be, you know, soon that we see very many fruits of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's mostly going to be like tech demos, right?
Ubuntu, yeah. Unity, I mean, seems like it's taken off pretty quickly.
But I mean, like Unity has been a thing, you know, for the entire run of this show. Like I remember talking about like. Slender back towards, you know, back in like 2013 and being surprised that was a Unity game and having to like wrestle with the plugin. It's more like ubiquitous now, but like it's had a ramp, like it's been available for, you know, kind of consumer and developer use for a long time.
Sure, I suppose so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious to know if the, like how accessible this is, because it seems like it is powerful and it is free, but that doesn't mean that it's oriented towards someone who is getting into game design. Mm-hmm. From the video, it seemed like this is a very advanced studio that doesn't have a lot of concessions to tutorials or you know, leading people along or making it simple and accessible. This is meant for someone who knows their shit.
Yeah, and I'll be curious too, because one of the big things about Unity and the way that Unity makes a lot of their money is through the asset store, by providing like a marketplace for people to make and sell things. So I'll be curious if they have that there in order to kind of facilitate some of this development, because that definitely makes developing stuff, at least as far as I've heard, in Unity a lot easier and more approachable. Yeah, I'm specifically interested in the Twitch multiplayer integration and to see of like how widespread that is. It's probably going to be limiting if you have to develop a game from the ground up. Like, it seems like that'll like balkanize development to a certain extent, because there are a lot of houses that build most of their stuff in Unity or in Unreal or whatever. And if this isn't comparable to those on other features, that'll be kind of weird. It'll put people in a different spot, especially if they're enthusiastic about that, kind of those things that are unique to Amazon Lumberyard.
Yeah, agreed.
Huh. I'm going to throw in real quick with one. I can't remember if I've spoken about this before. I went back through the notes and I couldn't see. Breath of Fire 3 just came out on PSN.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, I thought it would never happen because we didn't get the PSP port, and I thought there was some kind of like license thing, but apparently there's this weird alternate. So again, talking about the time storm, like Capcom has just decided to bring all their shit here 10 years after they ought to have before. So first we get Mega Man Legends and now this. And yeah, so like it'll play on the Vita, I think on the PSP and on the PSTV, because it is the PSP port that they have like brought forward with this. Uh-huh. But that is not substantially different, and you still get that baller soundtrack. So I have already downloaded it and played the opening dungeon, and it holds up just as well as I would expect it to, which is, it's a JRPG, but it's a JRPG I harbor a lot of affection for. And for like $10, it's here devaluing one of the more valuable games that I have, but it's more important to me that that more people are able to play it.
Very cool.
Yeah. Let's see then. David, how about you? What you got?
Sure. So apparently, for a brief period of time, several games, most notably Red Dead Redemption, were backwards compatible on Xbox One, as long as you had bought it and had a friend who had bought it, and you went into his list of recently played games and checked his game.
How would and anybody then have discovered it? That? How would anybody have discovered that?
I mean, yeah, clearly that is a completely legitimate and non-shady way to receive this game. I mean, clearly there was no malfeasance or other big words involved. Microsoft has since taken these games away as long as you're connected to the internet. They've apparently, what they said happened is that they were testing for making the game backwards compatible, but weren't ready yet or hadn't decided if it was going to be backwards compatible. So, somehow it, slipped through one of the time storm tears and ended up on the Xbox One. So,
that's okay. So, testing, you can't be testing something for backwards compatibility if the entire game is there working. Like,
yeah, you can. Like, they would load the disk image on, or they would have a build of it, and they probably accidentally published it in a weird way. Like, they can't just like engineer a whole new vertical slice and put it on there, to the best of my knowledge. Or like put like a partial game, because like that would be weird.
Yeah, I just maybe this is showing my lack of knowledge about programming, but it seems weird to me that you could be just seeing if something will work and accidentally have the whole thing go live in a functioning format. I mean, maybe it just worked way better than they thought it would, or the Xbox One is way better at, you know, being backwards compatible than they're letting on.
I smell a conspiracy.
It's aggressively backwards compatible. It actually, the Xbox seek out games in order to force them.
Yeah. So I mean, like, I can, and, you know, they don't, like, have access to the source or anything, I don't imagine. Like, they don't just hit up Rockstar and say, yo, you got that RDR piece?
Actually, according to this, apparently that's exactly what they do.
What? That's because, so bizarre.
Well, I mean, not necessarily in that words, but they're saying part of the, some of the issues with that is that they, apparently they can't just make something backwards compatible. They have to go to the publisher, and the publisher has to, like, get their whatever in a form that it's ready to become backwards compatible.
That's weird, huh? So, like, I would just imagine that'd be an image or something like that. Like, I would imagine most of the testing are, like, you know, aside from business reasons, right? Because business reasons are always going to get in the way and, you know, take, you know, overtake technical reasons. And that makes me angry. But, like, you know, if it is a technical reason, you know, because I understand, like, Red Dead Redemption is a very difficult game to port. And that's why I never, like, came out on PC, because Rockstar was doing some just bug nuts crazy shit with that engine by the time that game came around. It makes sense to me that they would be like, hey, come and get this. But, like, most of the, I don't know, am I wrong? Most of the, like, tweaks and stuff, why something isn't automatically backward compatible is they have to, like, they have to write some exceptions to, like, the emulation or the software. Emulation to make sure that it handles all the stuff correctly. Like, there are games that behave differently depending on if you've installed them on your hard drive, right? And so when you are playing this, like, it doesn't matter if you have the disc, it's still on your hard drive, and so they have to, like, write around those different special cases.
Sure. Yeah, that definitely, I mean, that seems like makes sense. Like, especially, like, kind of like you said, you know, see that being the case if they're kind of pushing the limits of the hardware by using, you know, tricks and hacks and stuff. Mm-hmm. But what kind of surprises me is that they were, you know, apparently testing this on this might not be the correct terminology, but, you know, on a live server as opposed to, like,
in a production environment.
Yeah, as opposed to, like, booting up a, you know, AWS instance, you know.
They've gotten enough free juice from us. We can pinch the juice,
right? But I mean, seriously though, like, it does it does kind of surprise me that
it's weird. Like, it sucks that this is only temporary, because Red Dead Redemption is a good game. I kind of take this as good news though, right? Because it's planned, like, they're working on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
although being Microsoft, this could just be a tease in order to, you know, get their monthly required amount of evil.
I don't know. Microsoft's more like hapless than evil. Now.
Yeah, but, like, maybe this could actually be smart. Like, if you think about it, maybe they can get their incompetence out on, like, a relatively, you know, not, I don't know.
Yeah. How do you feel about this, Ben? You're the one who's played the most Red Dead Redemption here.
I was going to bring up the fact that Red Dead Redemption 2 was announced for this coming year, and I wasn't sure if that was a fresh news story or not, but I'm looking up articles, and apparently that's a couple months old. But
I had no idea. That seems like something we would have talked about.
Yeah. I guess we're talking about it now. I don't know.
Our massive teams of researchers have failed us.
Damn it, Daryl. Yep.
So, like, in this one, you apparently become more redempt?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's Red Dead Redemption.
Ooh, it's Red Dead Resurrection. Marston's back, baby.
Spoiler.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where we ask you a question and you answer it. This is the listener participation portion of the show. Dennis, what is the question that you ask the nice people?
The question is, what games do you most enjoy speedrunning or watching speedruns of? Or I should say, what games do you most enjoy speedrunning or watching speedruns of?
So you can't do it like in a monotone, though. Like you still have to bring a little bit of the melodicism of regular speech to it. So, you know, like, what games do you most enjoy speedrunning or watching speedruns of?
There you go.
It's pretty good.
You've practiced that, haven't you?
I still tripped over it like 3 times. So not to like get in here. I feel like I'm correcting you guys a lot today, and I'm very sorry about that.
The trick is that Cole is actually just saying watermelon, watermelon over and over, but because the inflection, we heard it as the actual thing.
Yeah, it's like those paragraphs where they double words and you don't even notice because of some Malcolm Gladwell shit about the way brain works.
In general, the brain works on bullshit.
So I'll pick us up with our first response here, which is Ollie saying to watch Dark Souls. We need to work on coming up with questions to which the answer is not Dark Souls.
There aren't very many.
I'm not putting you on blast, Ollie, but I just want to. It has been a trend for about the entire 3 years we've been a show. But I'll continue. To watch Dark Souls, it is a thing of beauty to see the very best players take that game down in mind-bogglingly short times. The game kicked my ass so many times, it's like seeing your high school bully get beaten up when Lobos Jr. or someone wrecks it. To play, I played a lot of platformers on the PC in the early 90s and think that even now I could post a decent time on Duke Nukem, Shrapnel City, or Commander Keen 4. I could probably draw a map of their levels without going back over it. Yeah. So Dark Souls speedruns are good. He mentions Lobos, and like Lobos has turned speedrunning Dark Souls, like that isn't enough for him anymore. So, you know, starting at least with Dark Souls 2, he started like doing challenge runs, and those are what I like to watch. But only in, you know, kind of like small measures. Like I want to get like highlights of them and stuff. I like the idea that somebody is doing them.
Yeah.
Have you guys watched like Dark Souls speedruns?
It can be done.
Yeah. I like knowing that that he's out there taking it easy for all us sinners.
I have watched, again, not full speedruns very often, but you know, clips of it and just the stuff that he specifically and then speedrunners in general are able to do is pretty incredible.
Yeah. Hmm. David, what does Robert say?
Sure, Robert says, I'm a lazy speedster in Kingdom of Loathing. 2 days hardcore, I forget what CS is now. I'll watch someone speedrun any game I've played before, especially stunt runs.
Yeah. I've played Kingdom of Loathing before. How do you speedrun it? Is it just an optimized path through the different kind of challenges or what?
Yeah. I mean, the core game, you know, you play, you know, over and over again, and yeah, there's a lot of you know, there's only a very small amount of the content that you actually have to do to beat the game. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the other content will give you certain perks. So for example, like after you beat one of the like mid-level quests, that then opens up an additional quest that basically doubles the amount of food you can eat in a day. Mm-hmm. Which every time you eat food, you get more turns that you can do that day.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a thing where, you know, you have to decide, is the time I spend, you know, completing this quest going to be, you know, outweighed by the time I save by being able to eat more food?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a lot of things like that. It tends to be a lot of decisions like that. And then for like high end stuff, a lot of, like advanced planning.
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you for educating me.
Yeah. This was actually going to be one. This is, I think, the only game I've speed racered. And I wasn't very good, so I think mine was like between like 2 weeks and a month. But it was pretty good considering I've had like 1 year runs before. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see, Ben, what does Steven say?
Steven says, for me, it was most definitely has to be Dark Souls, because what else? though my fastest run is only 4 hours because of ONS.
Ornstein and Smo.
Okay.
Yeah, 4 hours is still really good.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't do 4 hours.
I think I beat Ornstein and Smo in 4 combined hours.
four hours total of dedicated work trying to beat those guys.
In the room with them.
Yeah.
So these Dark Souls speedruns, are these like the higher end ones, are they glitch based, or is it strictly through the non-linearity of Dark Souls?
So there's only there are only a certain number of bosses that you need to defeat. I can't rattle off the list off the top of my head for that, but it is far fewer than you would think based on how big the game is. Sure. A lot of the ridiculous ones where it's like sub 1 hour. I forget if the best run is under an hour. Maybe it's like 45 minutes. I haven't paid attention in about a year or so, so it could totally change. But yes, a lot of them do take advantage of glitches, but there are different flavors. There are 100% speed runs. There are like soul level 1 speed runs, different kind of things. So all of those kind of add in different complications. But they are kind of a combination of knowing how to cheese damage, knowing how to take advantage of glitches, and then just kind of a bog standard, like, this is the fewest number of gates that I need to pass through.
Sure.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Dennis, what does Eric say?
Eric says, I like watching... Oh, crap, I moused over an ad that popped something up. Okay. Eric says, I like watching unique speedruns, ones where the runner places a rule on themselves that the game itself doesn't impose. The Soul series is great for those, Lobos Jr. I also like learning about game-breaking mechanics, like how warping glitches broke down Ocarina of Time to 20-ish minutes, or Person 2012's insane video about glitching a scuttlebug up to a platform before building up speed for 12 hours to travel to a different parallel universe in order to shave off half of an A press for the theoretical lowest amount of A presses in a run of Mario 64. I didn't know that lowest A press runs was a thing. I didn't know that, and then two, I didn't know that half presses were counted.
So you need to watch the video. It's 25 minutes, and it's kind of become it's definitely a meme. Like, you see references along with a picture of a scuttlebug, which the monster designs of Mario 64 are fucking absurd. But it's become something like worth laughing about. I think he does a really good job of explaining what he does, like those kind of annotated speed runs where somebody like goes in and says like, hey, this is how I accomplish this. Like, if you just watch it, it looks like Mario is, you know, he falls into the stage and then runs up a slope and then is at the star. And it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And he takes 25 minutes to explain this 12-hour process that he uses to take advantage of the fact that Mario behaves differently while the A button is held. And he counts it as half of an A press because over the course of a whole run, he is still holding down the A button from a previous stage, when he warps in. So that is not counted as an A press. Another part of the meme is that that there are three parts to an A press: pressing, holding, and releasing. And so, you know, he explains it, and like, you can buy or not buy his reasoning. I don't know why somebody would do this, except, you know, the why is Everest, or why do people climb Everest reason? Like, oh, because it's there. You have to, like,
or
find...
Like, who's his challenger?
Oh, it's him. It's definitely him.
Who's he? Yeah, who's he trying to justify to? It's like, see, I beat you, self.
See, I like to imagine that for all these people, it's like, was it, you know, when the Grim Reaper comes, you can challenge him to a game.
Oh, is he seventh sealing? Is he trying? Yeah, is he fighting for his soul?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I like to imagine.
Yeah.
So if there's three parts to an A button, how does he have a half press?
Because he justifies it. I forget. I can't like recite his explanation. Like, it doesn't make much sense in so far as why would somebody do this and why would they try to defend it. But yes, he somehow talks his way around, like, his version of the rules makes it so there is a half of an A press.
So that hurts my mind.
I think my favorite stunt run I've ever seen is, there's a, a buff or whatever in Kingdom of Loathing called Teleportitis that basically makes it so you can't, you know, the way the game's structured, you basically, there's tons of different areas and you choose where to spend adventure and, you know, you fight a monster, you know, something happens. Yeah. And this this buff basically makes it so you can't choose where you adventure. No matter where you click, it just chooses a random one from one of them that's open to you. Mm-hmm. And so someone did a run where they spent the entire run in Teleportitis. but it was both kind of cool, but it was also kind of interesting because it wasn't nearly as hard as you would expect, just because it basically boiled down to being good enough to know what the best option was in whatever situation presents itself.
Yeah. So, well, and is run an option in Kingdom of Loathing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so theoretically, if you got in over your head, you could just kind of bow out of a fight.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and the consequences for dying aren't all that bad, really.
Yeah, but watch that video. Like, those kind of annotated speedruns, like, the only thing that is against this is that he over-explains it. But he uses animations and stuff to, like, show what he's doing. And, I don't know, I find it interesting, if not a little bit goofy. But, you know,
yeah,
good things are interesting and goofy. Let's see here. Dennis, what does Jeffrey say?
Jeffrey says,
"Oh wait, did I throw off to you?"
Yeah, I was going to say,
yes,
I
did.
I'll do two in a row, but
yep, I'll pick up with Jeffrey saying,
"Okay,
my favorite one involves two games. Mr. K ran SimCity and Maniac Mansion simultaneously a few years back on Awesome Games Done Quick, and it hits that magic balance of interesting game exploits and a charismatic runner that is so rare." I don't understand.
How do you speedrun SimCity?
Maybe it's time to Metropolis. I think he's speaking specifically about. Let me open the video real quick.
Yeah, I'm watching. Would be really interesting is if he had like the same inputs were going to both games simultaneously.
Oh gosh, that'd be ridiculous. Wait, at what point does he bring in Maniac Mansion? Oh, it's only like partway through. Oh, and he's picking up different controllers. Okay. Yeah, so he is playing what appears to be the SNES version of it.
Huh.
Yeah. Of SimCity or Maniac Mansion?
Of SimCity. There's, and the NES version of Maniac Mansion. And he's putting it on, so when he is advancing time in SimCity, he is playing Maniac Mansion. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's pretty good. Man, I want to play Maniac Mansion again. I love that game so much.
Is that game widely available on updated systems, or has that not come out again?
No, it's pretty hard to get a hold of. I'm curious when Day of the Tentacle comes out, if they're going to include the full original version. The problem with that is it's not the NES version, which has the soundtrack. And that soundtrack is essential to play in that game, I think.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah. But yeah, that is pretty good. And like I really wish I had like more, I don't know, time is the wrong word because you really only need to watch the highlights or whatever. I like hearing stories that come out of AGDQ, and like it's obviously a really cool event. But when we get to our responses, we're gonna find out that I just go, yeah, speedruns, neat. David, what does David say?
Sure. David says Super Metroid 100% was amazing to watch. For myself, the only thing I've ever speedrun was the community service challenge path in Kingdom of Loathing. Using only the vanilla interface and no scripts, I got a 3-day hardcore run down to just under 9 minutes.
Nice.
It blows my mind that second to Dark Souls, which is obvious, Kingdom of Loathing is the most mentioned speedrun.
Is that surprising? Like, there's a lot of like crossover between us and the Video Games Hot Dog guys. In terms of listeners, yeah.
I would not have thought of that as a game that you speedrun, though.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure.
See, yeah, it's actually kind of a lot of the game is speedrunning.
Does like buckle down at high levels to like browser speed?
Not so much that, because people tend to do kind of like people are saying, since you have a certain number of turns per day, it tends to be based on like how many days and then also like how many turns.
Gotcha.
Like I said, I've never really gotten into it too much, but if I remember in the past, it used to be that, you know, it was quote unquote like relatively easy to do a run in one day, at which point it then became very much like how many turns can you do it in? I'm not sure if that's still the case.
Gotcha.
And when you say one day, it is one day's worth of energy.
Right, exactly.
Yep. Okay, so it's not really time-based, it's resource-based.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Ben, what does So say?
Pac-Man. That's it.
I don't know if So is shitting with us or not.
I'm going to jump in. This is actually very apropos since I talked about the place, the Retro Arcade, earlier. They're actually hosting an event on March 19th. Apparently, he's friends with the world record holder for the fastest perfect game of Pac-Man.
Yeah, he lives in Dayton.
Yeah, I did not know this. But anyway, apparently the place is hosting this guy on March 19th, and he's going to do a live attempt at completing his seventh perfect game.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So it is also for an amazing cause. They are raising money to fight cancer.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So Pac-Man can be speedrun. Sped-run? Pac-Man can be sped-run.
Spod-ran. Yeah. Huh. I kind of want to take a portable recorder there.
That could be pretty cool.
Huh. Remind me when it gets closer.
I can always reach out and see what he's up for.
Yeah. Neat. Can you give me like a little bit of detail on what a Pac-Man speedrun entails? Because like you can't make Pac-Man go any faster.
Well, eventually you get to the kill screen, though. So I'd assume it's just who can get to the kill screen.
It's also, it has to be all about efficiency, right? The most efficient route to clear a board.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And escape the ghosts, obviously. And advance through the levels to, you know, the kill screen.
The hardest part's not eating the pretzel. I see it and I just want to bite it up. I gotta go for it. I don't care if there's a ghost there.
No pretzel ghosts.
This is such a weird episode.
I don't know what the reference is, but I'm going to assume it's Steve Brule.
No, I'm just speaking in a weird voice. It is no more complicated than that. Dennis, what does Michael say?
Michael says, the Diablo series. The length of the games makes them more like meander runs. But even so, watching players adapt to the randomized drops and monsters makes each attempt unique. It takes you along on a surprisingly personal journey. I hadn't thought about it from that angle, but now having played some Diablo, I totally agree. It's not a roguelike, right? But it's got that element of randomness to it that makes everything unique and everything kind of situational. You'll never see the same scenario exactly twice. So
it's one of those things, though, because like anytime there's an element of randomness in these challenge runs, what happens is people know what the loot table for like one of these different places look like. They know if I kill this certain enemy, he has a chance of dropping this kind of weapon with this kind of modifier. And then what happens is they go and kill it, and if they don't get what they need at their first kill, they will restart, because that is a run killer if they don't get what they need.
Yeah, I could see that being really frustrating.
Yeah. So yeah, not to come in and like piss on this, but yeah.
Well, I don't think I think it just means that you need to seek out the ones where they got what they wanted versus waiting through a bunch of ones where they didn't.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, that's
I feel like it would be incredibly passive aggressive to just post a ton of YouTube videos of like you aborting speedruns.
That was a practice.
Yeah.
I'm going to round us out here with Sam, who writes in saying, first party N64 games, because those were basically held together with duct tape and bubblegum before the speedrunning community ran all over them. Yeah.
We're all out of bubblegum.
it's always funny when speedrunners talk to the developers and say, did you know that if you ran into this corner of this polygon when this enemy was standing right here that this would happen? And they're like,
do you want a QA job?
Because then that wouldn't happen.
Speaking of that, our conversation with Eduardo about him learning from speedrunners on Phoenix Furia, he kind of literally did that with speedrunners, sat down with them, was like, okay, here's what they did to break it.
Yeah. Neat. So I'll get mine out of the way because I really don't have any. I don't speedrun stuff, and I tend not to seek that out, mostly just because of I'm not in a situation where I can, like, watch a lot of videos for a long time. Like, I don't watch a lot of streams either. So take my non-participation more as, like, a fault of my own and not, like, you know, me saying speedrunning is dumb. It's totally not the case.
Sure. For me, the favorite one to speedrun is Dead Core, which I can't remember how long ago it was I talked about on the show, but it is speedrunning the game. and that just, you know, it felt really good to go fast in that. And it was, you know, it was accessible enough that I could, without a ton of mastery, feel like I was going really fast, but still deep enough that, you know, as I practiced areas and you know, I saw significant chunks of time fall off. Mm-hmm. So it was really rewarding. And then to watch, I have to say Spelunky. And that has very much the thing you alluded to with Diablo, where it's like you need to get the first box you open needs to be a teleporter, and the second box you open needs to be a jetpack. Otherwise, don't even bother trying.
Yeah.
But, you know, looking up the videos where that happens and watching someone use those items with skill. Whereas whenever I have a teleporter in that game, I just jump straight into a wall. that is something really crazy to watch go down.
So this is definitely a fault of mine, but, like, knowing what goes into making one of those perfect runs that somebody has restarted the whole time, when I look at a perfect one, all I can feel is the stress of those logistics.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, it's been a while since I've been to an amusement park, but, like, I can't imagine going to Disney World and thinking anything other than, how do they clean up puke on that ride?
They spin you around so fast that the puke goes away from the roller coaster.
Yeah, it's a centrifuge. But yeah, Spelunky, that is a good answer. How about you, David?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think in terms of doing it, you know, Kingdom of Loathing, in terms of, like, ones I actually like to watch, I'm not sure I've ever watched a speedrun. Although I do kind of want to make some sort of joke about, like, if Twitch plays Pokemon could count as, like, a three-legged race.
Oh, wouldn't a three-legged race would be kind of like the speed runs where one person holds one side of the controller and another person holds the other side? Like, there was a Super Metroid run at a recent Awesome Games or Summer Games event where they did just that. And if you just watch the screen and not them, you would think it was just an expert. But, like, them being so in sync is, like, just unfathomable to me.
Well,
yeah.
It's like Pacific Rim. I do like what was I was watching the I think I've mentioned it before, the playthroughs of survival horror where one person's basically the arms and the other person's the legs. just seeing people trying to run away when they don't have power to run away is pretty entertaining.
Human Centipede, the game.
Oh no. Don't say that. You're gonna will it into existence. Oh gosh. Yeah, and how about you, Ben?
So I was trying to think of ones. I don't the only games I think I've speedrunned are ones where they make you speedrun it, like the ending of Halo or like 1080. I think one that I actually did and legitimately was GoldenEye, how they would have the time challenges for each of the maps. You would get like a reward. I did do all of those at one point in time, so I think that's the only speedrun I've done. I've watched a speedrun of Portal before, and I think that was how I was introduced to the game, so that was kind of interesting, but yeah.
Oh man, setting expectations way too high.
Wait, yeah.
Not for the game, for your ability to perform the game.
Right. Yeah, no.
You can't live up to that expectation.
What's kind of funny, too, is I saw him do a puzzle in, like, a broken way, and so I assumed that that was the solution. And so I think I solved the puzzle like that every time I had played it until somebody actually did it the right way. And,
That's funny.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
So are Shadow of the Colossus speedruns a thing? Because that seems like that could be kind of badass.
They built a speed challenge mode into the game.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Yeah. I guess I have played that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, but like, so those speed challenges, like, depending on the Colossus, they can get down to like 2 minutes. So it's probably something like they wiggle the stick in a certain way, and then they just like, all of a sudden I'm on top of the dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only half an A press.
Oh. Well, thank you, everybody, for responding to that. Hopefully it wasn't too quick for you. But if you want to take part in these, they go up Tuesday afternoons usually on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thelevelpodcast.
The grind.
Now it is time for the grind, where we talk about the games we've been playing over the past week or so, in some cases longer. So I'm going to throw it to you, David, since you were away last week, and Dennis, you'll be up next.
Okay.
Sure. I've actually been a little bit busy, so I haven't been playing a ton, but I've got into Darkest Dungeon.
Oh, neat.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That recently came out in full release.
Yep.
Had you played it before when it was in early access?
Yes, but very, very briefly. You know, like just one or two runs. So, yeah, I really enjoy it. Yeah, really, really cool art style, and very, very excellent voice acting.
Yeah.
I really like I like the tone of it. I feel like it does a really good job of kind of balancing between being, you know, it's a very dark game, but it, you know, kind of kind of the point of the game is people dealing with the stress and the, you know, the negative effects of, you know, adventuring and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. So this is the, just for people who are listening, this is Darkest Dungeon. It is kind of a side scrolling small numbers RPG, with the main mechanic being that as you suffer setbacks in this dungeon that you're going into, your characters will develop conditions in response to it, whether it's kleptomania, whether it's paranoia, any of those. And you have to kind of manage their mental health along with their physical health in order to delve deeper.
Right, exactly. And in general, it's, you know, it's a game where, you know, it's roguelike, but it really emphasizes the degree to which, you know, things can go very badly, very quickly, and in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. But what I like about it is, but because it's about dealing with those things, you know, it's a very dark game, but it also kind of balances that with, you know, there's kind of a dual theme also of hope, which is kind of cool. I don't know. I feel like talking about the game, it's kind of tough because like so much of the stuff that makes the game just really awesome is kind of the fine balance of, you know, how things are set up. So like it's
a systems game. I mean,
right.
You have different classes, but mostly that relates to how they perform in the marching order. Like the marching order is a really big deal in this game.
Right, exactly. So, you know, any given character, you know, from a certain position can, you know, each of their attacks can only be used in certain amounts of the position. So, you know, maybe melee attacks can generally only be used if you're in the front two positions and can only target the front two positions, whereas ranged attacks usually can only be used in the back two positions, but again, you know, can't target the front positions.
Mm-hmm. And like, so can you get in situations where your people are like guaranteed to die because they're not equipped to be in the position they're in?
Well, I mean, you can move. you can move your characters, but then there's also a lot of abilities that either will force your opponents to move, or so for example, one of the classes is a bounty hunter that's equipped with like a grappling hook. And so he has a whole bunch of moves where he can, you know, throw the grappling hook and pull someone forward. Mm-hmm. Similar, there's classes that are based around being able to move themselves forward and backwards. So, you know, they might have like a lunge attack that, you know, does a lot of damage and then like moves them to the front of the party.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it really, in a lot of situations, you know, playing with it, you know, really gets a lot of the feel of it. So, like, I just got a new hero that is a lawman who has all his attacks revolve around this dog he has with him. And because, you know, it's not actually him attacking, it's, you know, him sending out his dog, you know, whereas most enemies usually like a given attack will generally, you know, you can use it from, say, 2 out of 4 and you can attack 2 out of 4. All of his abilities, basically, you can use usually from like 3 out of 4 positions and 2, 3 out of 4 because, you know, it's actually his dog running around for him. Yeah, so it's really, really neat kind of the feel they get.
It like to me in the limited exposure that I've had of this, it feels like they've taken what would be in a grid based strategy RPG, and Dennis's ears just perked up, and simplified it and collapsed it in such a way that it feels almost like you're playing a card game.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's
holy shit, two of my favorite things together in one in one sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it, because I think kind of like card game, card games tend to be in a lot of ways it's simplified, but not in a dumbing down way, but so more so in it's more, I guess, kind of elemental. For example, like one of the things is basically like there's only two damage over time effects. There's bleeding and blight, so they, you know, and, you know, so it's kind of all, you know, whereas most games would have like, you know, different types of poisons and stuff like that, they just kind of compress it down to one thing.
Okay. Yeah, so like it's not that you have so many different versions of that to manage. It's just different situations that it arises in.
Right, and consequently, it almost ends up selecting your party is almost like a deck building game. Yes. So for example, like one of the mechanics is marking targets, and so you might, for example, have want to have, say, like the bounty hunter in your party that's all about advanced planning, and so he has lots of abilities that can mark targets. And then if you have like the crossbow woman in your party, she has a lot of sniper abilities that then exploit marked targets. So there's a lot of things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so. tell me there's asynchronous co-op in this game.
Not that I know of yet. So
damn it.
That's in version 1.2.
That's the expansion.
Need more buzzwords. So I really enjoy the one thing I would say. I has been a little bit frustrating is particularly early on, I ran into some situations where basically I didn't have enough healers. And there were a couple runs where basically I was sending, sending in parties with the intent that none of them would survive. And so,
with the intent or with the knowledge, like, you wanted them all to die, or you just kind of knew it was going to happen?
little from column A, little from column B. Well, because part of it is recruiting. You can only recruit so many people after each run, but recruiting them is free, and likewise, there's no consequences to dismissing characters. So, you know, one of the other mechanics is your light level. So, you can either carry lots of torches around, and you know, that'll keep you from building up stress, and will, you know, make it easier to ambush enemies, stuff like that. Or if you run out of torches or just don't bring any, you know, you'll get more items, but your characters will also you know, quickly have nervous breakdowns. So, you know, doing runs where it's like, yeah, there's no way you survive, so I'm not actually going to send you with any food or torches. Yeah, I kind of feel like, you know, was that line from Futurama with Professor Farnsworth? What are you doing? Oh, you know, sending delivery teams off to their doom.
Well, isn't your player character kind of, or the intro sets it up that you are an eccentric old man sending people into this dungeon to get his inheritance, right?
Well, you are the like the descendant of a eccentric old man, that you know, delved too deep, and you know, yeah, ultimately the intro is him like sending off the letter and then offing himself.
Please, eccentric old man is my father.
Right. Although the interesting thing is that the narrator is that old man, which is kind of interesting.
That's funny.
Yeah. So I don't think that's actually like a plot point. Like, I don't think he's, like, actually alive or a zombie or something like that.
he's waiting at the center of the dungeon.
Yes.
You've disappointed me.
But, the whole thing, the whole thing does have a little bit of, you know, kind of a, I wouldn't say dark. Not dark humor exactly, because it's generally not done for humor. But I know, just kind of, you know, some of that sort of theme. Like your kind of your assistant in all this is this insane caretaker, and You have various places you can go to, you know, send heroes to relieve stress. But each time, you know, one of them is randomly being used by the caretaker. And
So it's a way to deny you a service randomly.
Yes, exactly. But then as he does it, he just has these like weird off-color commentaries. So the whole thing's very, very stylistic. It's very worth picking up.
Yeah, I'm down. Yeah. You been playing anything else, David?
No, I think that's about it. I a little bit farther in Saints Row 4. But that's kind of just more of the same. I like there's a sequence where they have a fully pretty fully realized side-scrolling beat-em-up.
I love that section. And I love that you take an ability away, like the jumping dive into the main world.
Yeah, and that they very explicitly call out that.
Yeah, that is a good game.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's see here. Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, so we'll start by talking about what I tried to play this week.
This sucks. I hated seeing this in the Slack channel, man.
Motherfucker, yeah. So the stars aligned, and XCOM 2 came out on my birthday.
Oh, no, that makes it so much.
February 5th.
If it was a day before or a day after, it wouldn't sting as much, would it?
I know, it was meant to be. And I like specifically, I don't think it was that night, but the night after, like I had specifically planned, cleared my calendar, got everything downloaded. I'm like, this is it. I know it's happening. And I drank coffee like leading up, cause I'm like, I'm going to be up to like 3 a.m. playing this bad boy. And so go to launch it and I get the notification of, oh, no, you know, your current Windows or your current Mac system, your current operating system doesn't support it. Please upgrade your operating system. And I was like, oh crap, I got to download the latest El Capitan, whatever. So I did that. That took like, you know, an hour or whatever. Fought through that. Okay, now I'm ready to go. Let's go. I'm all set up and hit launch and it says it's not supported by your computer. Or sorry, your computer is not able to run XCOM. Mm. So after much searching, I've tried to find out like what the hell. Like I've got a pretty good machine. It's a couple years old, but it was you know top of the line when I got it.
It's like a 13-inch MacBook Pro, right?
Yeah, and it's even got like upgraded a bunch of stuff to it. So like it's
so the problem is that it's integrated Intel graphics and not a dedicated card.
To my understanding, yes. And the thing that is super shitty about that is I went to the site, looked at the system requirements. And it said, you know, oh, you need your graphics card needs to be 1 gigabyte. And I don't know enough about the technical side of things to you know, understand everything that's going on here. But it said, you know, graphics card 1 gigabyte. When I pulled up about my Mac, it said it was 1.5 and change, right?
Right.
So I'm like, I should be fine. What's going on? And then I looked down and there's a list of specifically not supported video cards.
Yeah, specifically not like Intel Iris, not, yeah.
Exactly, and that my video card happened to be on that.
Yeah,
and so I feel like you know I went and tweeted you know at XCOM and Farrell who ported over to Mac being like, is this ever gonna change? And they're like, no, sorry, dude.
Yeah.
So XCOM just went from being a $60 game to a $2,060 game if I want to play it. Because the graphics cards on Macs are built into the system, and I can't just go and upgrade that specifically.
Right.
And I love XCOM. I love XCOM to pieces, but I don't love it quite that much.
Right. Like, this is a game you're going to play a couple years down the line.
I will play it at one point.
Right.
And I really had trouble bringing myself to click the refund button on Steam. So, which thank God for Steam refunds. I'm glad that having been someone who has to use it, I'm now glad that they have it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I got my money back, so no harm, no foul, I guess. But just the crushing disappointment of like being all amped up to play it and then not being able to. I just sat there and put my head down on the desk for a little. I didn't know what to do. Like once I figured out like, okay, no, this isn't just an error. Okay, no, this actually is something that is going to keep me from playing the game. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah, that's what we call a five stager. Yeah.
Oh my God. So instead I booted up and played the Magic Circle. Right. Which actually did make me feel a lot better. So
cool.
Substituted it with something that was also good, and redeemed it a little bit. Which Cole, you've said a lot about this game, the Magic Circle, that is.
Yes.
So I don't know how much I have to add to it at this point. I think I'm still relatively early on. I just killed the first Securitron. If that places it at all.
Okay, yeah, I believe so. Like, have you gotten to the overworld? Like, it opens up, and then it's like, oh, you gotta, you know, go to these different places. Are you still in the ship? I forget the first Securitron.
Okay, no, I don't have a handle on how standout it is that I just killed this enemy type. It's the first time I've encountered of it, but that could be the first time of many, and it's not really significant. Yeah.
And this is distinct from the door opener robot.
Yes, distinct from the door opener robot. It's got a rail gun and it's at the end of a hallway.
Oh yeah. And no, you're pretty far in, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. So the way I figured out the thing that was really liberating about this game, it's got a lot of meta like commentary in it, but not in a Stanley Parable way. You could draw a lot of parables.
Yay!
You could, and I know Cole, you've kind of touched on this, but you know, like you could draw a lot of parallels. But I feel like the Magic Circle has a lot more to say,
mm-hmm.
Whereas the the Stanley Parable feels kind of like a trick or a magic trick. This feels more like a story.
Yeah. Like the Stanley Parable is it is precisely impressionistic in a way that like it's trying to like one quarter say about 17 different things. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly mm-hmm. trying to insinuate that through detail and trickery as opposed to this, which definitely, I mean, like by the time you get to the end, you'll realize what the thesis of it is. You know, everything is kind of like finely crafted. And I think that, you know, the fact that you are dealing with different NPCs and different characters aside from the narrator, mm-hmm. And you know, you're getting this information through dialogue as opposed to this narrator who is going back and forth between describing what you're doing, insinuating, you know, your intentions, kind of prescribing what's going to happen next by manipulating the world. I think mm-hmm. that, you know, for as meta as like the game about game development thing is, it's much more, it comes across as much more genuine and direct in that way.
I agree with that. But anyway, there's a quote at some point in it where basically they say straight up to you, like, you know, you might at some point start wondering, like, am I doing things the way that the developer intended me to? Fuck that.
Fuck and perfect. Perfect's what's got it. Perfect is what got us here.
Yeah, exactly. And that they say it in those words. And it's basically like, if it works, it is the right thing to do. And I felt a burden lift off my shoulders.
Yeah.
When they said that, it's like, okay, now I've got like free reign. Like I have permission now almost to, like, I don't have to worry about whether or not I'm finding the right answer. I just have to find the answer.
Like, you know, they're like, there is no exact correct elegant solution. You can pursue several inelegant versions of it that kind of lend the feel of playtesting this thing. Like, yeah, it's almost like a little bit of a transgression. Like, they didn't intend for, you know, in the fiction, the developers didn't intend for these things to interact in this way. Did the actual developers intend for them to interact this way?
Exactly.
I don't care. It's getting a result. It's not moving very quick, and it's like kind of a little bit frustrating getting it to work, but here we are, and like, it is part of the experience.
Yeah, exactly. And so just them being open about that or saying that makes the puzzles and their solutions feel that much more open-ended. Mm-hmm. Because they're acknowledging, like, no, we don't have a put together perfect way. If you find what feels like an alternate way, you're not breaking something. It's just that's the way it's supposed to be, which is really cool. So anyway, I defeated this Securitron, this guy at the end of the hallway with a railgun that kills anything that comes near him, by like spawning in a ton of other minions, basically everyone else that I'd interacted with in the game, and just kind of having them run at him. So I used the meat shield methodology.
You Branniganed it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I Branniganed it. And like, it just barely worked. I did get to him in mm-hmm. time before he could shoot me. And I don't know if that was the way I was supposed to solve it, but it worked and it felt really good. And the entire game is just made up of moments like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I am enjoying it heartily. And I don't know how close I am to the end. It's I've played it for about 2 hours. Steam tells me. So I don't know if that's close to the end of the experience or not.
By the time you get the ability to fly and you go to kill the Sky Bastards, you've entered the end game. So,
okay.
Gauging how close you are to the end, like, use that as like, okay, now I'm entering the last third. Like, that's the beginning of the final act.
Yep. Yeah. So I'm closing in on the end then.
Yeah.
Which is all, you know, I don't feel like that's a bad thing at all, because it's a game that doesn't outstay its welcome then.
Yeah. I'm so excited for you to hear what you think about the end. We may do a post credits chat about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd be open to that.
Cool.
So I've been playing that. The other thing to shift to the final game is I started playing League of Legends.
Oh.
Yeah. I saw you mentioned that on Slack.
Yeah. So this is, I know there are entire podcasts dedicated to this games and people who know way more about it than me. So, if you are one of those people, please forgive me. I'm going to come at it from the complete newbie's standpoint. I have a friend who's really, really into it. And has just been recommending it to me on a couple different occasions. And
you're familiar with the genre because of, Heroes of the Storm, right?
I am. Yeah. So I've played Heroes of the Storm. I was talking to someone else about it and said that I've played Heroes of the Storm long enough to be good enough to play against truly good people.
Okay.
Like, like, you know, like I'm good enough to play against good people, which makes me really bad. Like my performance.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like I just good enough to get over the top and be in the same set as people who actually know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the, yeah, I know MOBAs from Heroes of the Storm, although that may or may not be a MOBA, a team brawler, whatever you call it.
I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
If you are going to split hairs on that, like I'll fight you in real life. Like,
wait. I think we could make an extra soda out of that.
I will not fight you in real life, but like they're different approaches to the roughly the same idea. Like they're at least, if not playing the same game, in ballparks that look very similar to each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just saying, we could find these people and we could sell bets.
You want to Uwe Bullet?
No, yes. Not really. I don't want to punch out Lurtak because he's got a family.
But yeah, so I at least had a grounding of the mechanics of that genre when I stepped in. But my first game absolutely hooked me. We were, you know, it was my first like PvP game. I did the tutorials, and we were sorely behind. Like the enemy was kind of in our base, and we had not pushed very far into their territory. So that, you know, kind of like this was how I expected my first game to go, right? Like, okay, I'm going to get my ass handed to me. It's going to be embarrassingly bad, and it'll be a learning experience. Mm-hmm. And I was starting to get, I don't know how to initiate this, but I was starting to get requests to surrender pop up. It was like, you know, so-and-so wants to surrender. Would you like to surrender? And it was, you know, five
Never!
People saying, yeah, well, five people, and it was 2-2. And a couple times I casted the, you know, don't surrender vote, because I'm like, I don't want to bail early on my first game. That feels bad. And like I said, it'll be a learning experience. So, you know, people were trying to get out. Everyone was considering surrender. They were in our base. I had died a couple times, but spawned in and had my ultimate ability for my character. So again, people familiar with the game, I was playing Ashe. She can basically shoot an arrow to any point on the map that does a lot of damage and freezes characters. So I fired that off the second I spawned in into a group of enemies and started running towards them. I was, you know, they were far enough into our base that it hit, and it didn't take me that much longer to catch up and start fighting them. But it hit four of them at once. My other teammates were able to clear out most of them, and then I actually arrived in person and cleaned up the last person remaining. So just this complete swing wiped out the other team all except for one person. And we were able to turn that into this huge momentum shift, claw our way back in, and win. And my God, I wound up being like the top earner in terms of both gold and experience, which are like the two key measures for a game. I was like shaking at the end of the game. Like I could not believe we had turned it around. I was amazed. People were like typing into the chat being like, "Woohoo, yeah, we're awesome," and stuff like this. And just so I it was an adrenaline rush, a level above what I've ever gotten from Here's the Storm. And just I think, you know, that type of game can happen anywhere. But the fact that it was the first game that I played in League just earned it a huge amount of affection in my eyes. And got me to keep on playing. So that was a huge first experience. My second game went like I expected my first game to, though. Just handed it to me and just got embarrassed.
You lost your beginner's luck. Yeah.
Yeah, I lost. Exactly. That's exactly what happened. But then I started playing with the friend that I mentioned who wanted me to play in the first place. We managed to be online at the same time. And just being alongside someone who is really good at that game is awe-inspiring. Like, you know, we were on Skype together, so we were kind of talking. He was like coaching me and walking me through what I needed to be doing at the same time as he was doing what he was doing. And we were just wrecking people.
Oh, that's great. It's always wonderful when somebody else makes you better and not in a condescending way.
Exactly. Well, and that's the really cool thing is at the end of a match, you can go through and give kudos, essentially. I think it's honor. You can honor both people on your team and people on the other team for being good team players, for being helpful, or for being like something else. Oh, there's honorable opponent. So the league actually, in a really cool way, facilitates, you know, being friendly towards each other.
Yeah.
But it was just funny because, you know, I'd be doing something, think I was doing really good. And all of a sudden he'd just go, get out, go, run. I'd be like, what? I was having fun. I was about to get the thing. And then like six enemies would come crashing through the brush where I was standing just a second before. And I'd be like, how did you know? And how are there six? There are only five people per team. Like,
spider sense.
So like, it was just like he had a sense for the game and just the way things were flowing. And it's just really cool. Like, to, you know, to be around that expertise and to benefit from it in a very tangible way. It shows that the game really is built around the teamwork and the kind of the being in your opponent's head, I guess.
Yeah.
Being in both your opponent's and your teammates' heads and anticipating and all that stuff. It showed that was a really meaningful part of the game.
Huh.
And I felt like I learned a lot just by playing with someone who was familiar with it. Yeah. So that was a lot of fun.
Your first experience with League of Legends is the most positive version of this experience I've ever heard from anybody who has tried to play a MOBA.
Yeah, no, I couldn't believe it myself.
Yeah. No, it's remarkable. Like, I'm not slagging on MOBAs. Like, they're tough to get into. So like, the fact that you have come away from this like feeling encouraged and not just like, well, I guess I'm gonna stick to fucking Pokemon or something. Like, that's too competitive. I don't know. Like, masturbating and telling myself stories. Like,
yeah, it's really funny, and it's led to because after my first two games I played by myself, every game I've played since then has been with this friend. So my win-loss ratio is phenomenal, right? Because I've only lost that one game, my second game. But my actual like contribution to the team is a little bit laughable at this point. Like, you know, I'm playing a character that's supposed to be one of the higher damage output characters on the team and be involved in a lot of player versus player fights. And I'm like one of the lowest kills on enemies at the end of the game. So it's, you know, it's the rest of the team carrying me right now, but my win-loss ratio is fantastic.
Yeah. Even if I don't enjoy the actual game that Riot has put together, like I'm no good at those kinds of things. The work that they are doing for user experience and for like community and behavior research management, I think is such a net positive for the industry.
Yeah,
that it is staggering, and I think it's going to improve so much of the rest of kind of like online interaction, like even outside of them, if people will just like look at it and pay attention. For as toxic as that community comes across sometimes, they're genuinely trying really hard, and like you'll read about these cool new initiatives that like come out and you know like, oh, that makes perfect sense, and when you find out that it works, it's really heartening.
So yeah, have there been ones that have been good or effective?
Yeah, like going all the way back to making it so you have to opt in to chat. The honorable player kind of initiative has worked out really well too. Tying your in-game kind of eligibility to play, like linking your discipline record with your forums record as well. You know, so that in-game behavior and out-of-game behavior are not like different things, and then putting in actual like gameplay penalties and incentives around either bad behavior or good behavior, that if not, you know, like making people better people, make them act like better people in the moment. You know, with a fake it till you make it kind of effect.
Yeah.
Like most of that to me has been like a net positive.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is the newbie perspective, and it was definitely different than I expected it to be. It helped in no small measure by playing with someone who's good at the game. So that maybe that's the lesson in all of this, which is if you want to get into one of these games, play with someone who is experienced.
Get as a Sherpa.
Get a Sherpa. Rent a Sherpa. I was worried that it was just going to jump me up into like a bracket of players because we were on the same team. So it kind of the matchmaking would jump me up versus people of a higher skill level.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not at all the case. Or at least if it was the case, I had enough help that it didn't matter. So having someone to show you the ropes is a big deal.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome to hear. I'll be curious for further stories as you kind of make your way in, if you decide to do that.
Yeah, we'll see. It's a great way to stay in touch with his friend, and mm-hmm. so that bodes well for me continuing to play.
Awesome. Ben, how about you?
I basically polished everything off that I've been working on. So I finished Until Dawn. It was cool, I guess. It's fine. It suffers the same problems that a lot of the games in the genre does, like Heavy Rain, where you notice kind of the lanes towards the end of the game, maybe.
Right.
I still thoroughly enjoyed the game. You know, I think I'm glad that they're making games like that. You know, like, I would like to see more games like that. So overall, I enjoyed the experience. Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say it's a game that's worth renting or buying if it's cheap, since it's kind of like a one playthrough type game.
Yeah.
I did a lot of kind of reading afterwards to see kind of like what all the different branches were, to kind of see like how far everything branched out. So it's kind of the same vein of Heavy Rain, where it's like everything's kind of, yeah, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Do or don't do that, depending upon how you like how you like those genre of games. But I had a relatively happy ending. I think only two of my people died out of 8 people or so.
Like for a story that's explicitly horror, that's pretty mm-hmm. good. Like
mm-hmm. Yeah, any other genre, that would be tragedy. But
right, like, you know, those are two candles snuffed out before their time. Mm-hmm. In looking at the way things can break out, can you tell me, like, what does success look like in the game? You know, can you get away with nobody dying?
The worst case scenario is everyone can die.
Okay,
I will say that much.
You can answer the question honestly. Like, if there's a character who's always fated to die, then that's okay.
I don't want to say, because I don't want to ruin the experience for anyone.
Okay. Yeah, you have to kill the bad guy, right? You have to kill Mike Myers.
This is for the love guru. Huh.
But yeah, I mean, yeah.
Looking at Supermassive's like portfolio, this is their first like huge project on their own, aside from like a Doctor
Who
game. First
Supermassive project.
I don't want to say that. Yeah, like this is their first kind of like original IP, it seems. And they're working on a PlayStation VR game called Until Dawn: Rush of Blood, which makes me sad. We'll never have a PlayStation VR.
Hmm. Yeah, the production on it is really nice. Like, the graphics are super polished. There's like, as you play the game, it'll unlock like behind the scenes sort of things, similar to like Uncharted. But like, so they'll do like behind the scenes and show you how they do like the mocap and the facial recognition or the facial capture. All of that's pretty impressive, and it definitely shines across the entire game. So that's cool. I will say, one small detractor of the game is some of the choices are kind of like stupid, where it's like you can kill an animal or not kill an animal. Like,
stupid. Well, like, well, you probably ought to not kill that dog. Like, it's just a dog. It's like,
yeah.
What is it? I mean,
stop the cat or not? Yeah.
Does it go like hardcore karma style or?
It's not like Fallout where it's karma. It's just that there will be certain points. The way they have it is it's called the butterfly system or the butterfly effect system or whatever. But there's like the cool thing that they do that like something like Heavy Rain didn't do is they will broadcast the effects of your choices like as you're playing the game.
They'll like they'll telltale it.
Yeah. And so like they'll have maybe I think 20 different slots and they'll have titles for each of them. And like as you make a choice, it'll say you chose to do this. And then later when something else happened, it'll say because you did this, this happened as well.
Oh, that's great.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is it seems like most games I know like shooting the dog, I'm going to regret. Like it. That's why I meant when I said does it do the karma thing is. I mean, it seems like kind of one of the flaws of a lot of horror stuff is
Yeah, it's not completely conservative where it's like the good choice is always the happiest ending. It's not always one-to-one like that. Sometimes there's a lot of kind of gray zones, but
okay.
That said, there's also a lot of super conservative choices as well. So there's a nice blend.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I'd recommend playing it if you like that type of game. Cole, you should definitely play it. I think you would enjoy it.
Yeah, I need to just find a free weekend to do it. I've been saying that for ages, but no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then outside of that, if there are any more questions for that, I beat The Witness, kind of. I beat the main part. Yeah, I know. I will never beat that game in full, I do not believe. But I beat the main branch, if there is one, to that game. So
if there is only one half to that game, if there is not like a second quest, which we can't confirm or deny.
It's super in depth. Like there's definitely a bunch of like challenge doors throughout the map, and like they're tough. Like even if you know the rules, you might have a hard time figuring out what it is. So
it's all explicit puzzles, right?
What do you mean by explicit?
I mean, it's all like, it's never like environmental puzzles or like, is it all like mazes and crap?
Yeah. I mean, all of them have the same mechanic of pathfinding. Sure. So
guess what I'm saying though, is it always like go up, activate a screen and do a puzzle, or is it ever actually like environmental or, you know, something like that?
By and large, it's mostly going up to a panel. Like, I would say 90 to 99% of the time, it's panels.
In my experience, even if it does break out of the panels, it's usually still lines and nodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so you're taking cues from the environment to help you learn how to solve the puzzles, but the environment is not directly solved. Or the environment is not directly involved in the puzzles.
Yeah, so basically the puzzles come in two forms. It's just straight logic, and there's lateral thinking puzzles. So both of them are in the game. So it's enjoyable. It's a good puzzle game. It's really elegant. I probably need to go back and read into some of the interpretations of the game, just because I kind of treated it like a puzzle game. So, but yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to be curious because I don't imagine Jonathan Blow is going to come out and say what the connection is between the line puzzles and the, you know, humanist philosophizing that he puts in there. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine there's not a connection, but I would love to just figure out what it is, even if, you know, it's weird. I should be down. Like, I'm down with all the component parts. The combination of them is just kind of like I can take or leave.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're playing this game right now too, Cole, right?
Yeah. It's been a bit because I was out of town this past weekend, so I was not able to make a lot of progress since we last spoke. But yeah, like I'm currently invested in at least seeing this through to some kind of conclusion.
Okay.
So what you're saying is that the sum is not necessarily more than the whatever. You know.
At least as far as I've seen, like there could be some kind of like grand catharsis where it all joins together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I have not seen that yet, and I know that Ben will not tell me if there is.
So what is kind of the pitch for the game? Because I watched some of a Let's Play. It just seemed to be kind of fairly bland puzzles, honestly. Like I'm not saying this trying to be like down on it. I obviously lots of people think it's amazing, and I couldn't figure out like what is the thing that people are thinking is amazing.
The thing I think that's impressive about it is like there's no narration. You're never explicitly told, hey, this is what this does. You know what I mean? Like, so by playing and beating the game, you build up this entire like knowledge vocabulary of like you're basically learning like a symbolic language, you know.
Okay.
But the entire time, it's all implicit. Like nothing is ever spelled out for you. You have to figure it out yourself. And so, I think that's really cool. So I would avoid looking up like answers. And I avoided doing that in playing the game. But I feel like that would definitely like devalue your enjoyment of the game.
Sure.
I've heard, having not played it myself, but that the game, you know, we talk a lot about the vocabulary of a game, or in terms of just the you know, tools at your disposal in the game. But that this game really does have a vocabulary in that the sense you're kind of learning a language that is hard to otherwise convey. And you know, like there's just kind of an implicit knowledge that you get as you solve these ever more difficult puzzles that you can't just, you know, if someone came to it at a later stage, it's very difficult to be like, oh, you know, this is what I'm doing here. You know, in these words, it's like, well, I've kind of learned this through this and this through this and this and I before E except after C and sometimes Y. And it's like all in a kind of action puzzle solving language that's hard to convey. And I think the building up of that language or the learning of that language is what's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And watching somebody else do that, you're going to see a solution. It doesn't ruin it in the sense of like, oh, now I know what this is, with the exception of like learning some of the twists or what some of the theses for the levels are. Or the different areas like that I could see being a bummer, but you just don't get the full effect because you haven't watched the path to get there.
Sure.
Right. And so, like, for me, I really enjoy this because it's like, it's a really pretty playground for my intuition. Mm-hmm. And it's a way to, like, stress certain, you know, or exercise certain parts of my, like, problem solving and visual and spatial abilities that, like, the real world and a lot of other games don't actually exercise in a way that, you know, like, the missed comparison is played out. But it does remind me of that, specifically the isolation and just the general overall beauty and the idea that this is all one big intricate machine, right?
Yes.
Like all of those things speak to me and like what I value specifically in a puzzle game or a game that is like this, like a first person adventure kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say that the game is like almost like pure elegance where it's everything is conveyed as compactly as possible. I think.
Nice.
Huh. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And I got one more thing. Thank you, Cole. You gifted me the beginner's guide last week, and I was able to play and beat that. Quote unquote, beat that. Yeah. So it's, it's hard to talk about the game because anything that you say about it kind of spoils it, you know? So, like, the first sentence I would open up with in talking about the game is would talk about the ending of the game. So
how did it make you feel? Because I've spoken, you know, it's the cat's out of the bag. I feel like it's a very emotionally affecting game, but
I mean, so parts of it you can kind of predict maybe with regards to the puzzle that they show multiple times. The payoff of that, I think, was you could kind of see coming. But then the narrative payoff was a little bit of a twist and unexpected. I don't know. So one thing I'm unclear on is I don't know if the game developer's trying to put himself in the perspective of I forget the person's name. But the person who's and if that's the case, if he's coming from that perspective, is he addressing people who talked to him when he made the Stanley Parable? So those are just things that I probably just need to do some more research into to see if other, you know, other people's opinions on them or any comments that he's made about the game himself. But
I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, you know, like from the get, you realize this is about the relationship between a huge fan and not only the work that they like, but the person that they see in that work and maybe possibly even the person they imagine in that work. And you see that, you know, because of the fact that he says this is a compilation of things that this person never wanted to see the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, that like that is the setup and it builds to a wonderful head.
So I have a question for you, Cole. So some of the things that they talked about with like the creative process, how like there are two different opinions on it. Like one that it's like frustrating and hard and it's easy to give up and you run out of ideas and lose steam. And another side of the perspective was like the hard part is part of the emotional payoff of, you know, the creative process. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess maybe those might not be two opposing opinions. They might both happen at, you know, the same time.
Yeah.
But I wonder kind of how did you relate to those sorts of opinions when you were playing the game?
Man, the idea of the engine just stopping.
Yeah.
Yep, I don't want to say anymore for spoiling it, but like that is incredibly like resonant for me. And like I see those as being kind of like complementary ideas. Like I don't think they're mutually exclusive, but like, you know, they both feed into each other eternal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. I'm glad you liked it.
I did.
Okay.
I mean, there's guns in it, so I have to like it, right?
Cool. Any other questions about this has been like a week of me giving games to people and them talking about games that I've already talked to death, so I apologize for that.
It's enjoyable. I got Firewatch today, but I haven't played it yet.
That leads into mine, actually.
All right.
I played What's that, Dennis?
I said hey-o.
Yeah. Which to be continued, because I played like the first 45 minutes of it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I played the first day, which I think is what a lot of people have seen either in videos or in like trade show demo kind of things. So I haven't gotten any kind of twist. I love the way that it opens up with like the text adventure.
Is that a spoiler?
No, I don't believe so. Ben, you have not played the game. Like you're getting ready to, right?
I'm getting ready to. I'm taking the earbud in and out of my ear.
No. It sets up the context in a way that I didn't expect. Like it is a prologue that is in a different genre that is kind of interspliced with the hike out to your watchtower. But like this is literally the first like 10 minutes of the game. But yeah, no, like it's really good. I like that team a lot. The Campo Santo Idle Thumbs guys, like, you know, the music is great. I think it's beautiful. Like the gameplay side of it, it does something interesting with, you know, the idea that like, yeah, really, you're just kind of like walking to a place and doing things, but what you're going through isn't a house. It isn't like this interconnected, very kind of like claustrophobic collection of halls and door, you know, hallways and doors. It's, you know, like this park, and you're following trails and you're looking at a map and you have a compass and, you know, your position updates on the map, but not your facing. And you're looking for, you know, again, looking for these paths and finding these supply boxes. So like moving from place to place is not a negligible challenge, because like it forces you to be attentive to what's going on around you. And I'm playing this with like surround sound headphones, and like one of the first things you have to do is nice. Like is find these people who are setting off fireworks, and you know, like occasionally you can get glimpses of, you know, where this is at, like, you know, they're off to the west, but like if you just listen, you can hear the fireworks going off, and then like, you know, like locate them that way. I think it's really beautiful. I like the interaction between the main character and the voice on the radio already. You know, a great deal. And like this is all kind of like tied in with like I really like the idea of like being on Firewatch, or like living in one of those like towers out there in the middle of nowhere. Like that seems really attractive to me, so like going out there and experiencing that virtually is a little bit of like fantasy wish fulfillment.
Nice. Cole, tell us, how did you find your calling as a forest fire watcher?
Yeah, I played this fucking game. I did the exact opposite of what this is, which is I stayed indoors. Yeah. Ben, I didn't spoil anything. Are you back?
I am back. It was campfire watch. You just stayed inside.
Yeah, it's comfortable in here. Yeah, so to be continued. I haven't played enough of it to really have an opinion, but like I dig it. It's good. So far, anyway, cool. Like they could start espousing some repugnant views later on, but I don't see that happening.
Good, I'm glad.
Yeah, I think that's about it. Do you all want to button it up?
I think so.
All right. The Credit. Thank you so much for listening. This has been level number 138 we're so happy that you're here. Let me think here in terms of business. Thanks everybody who has written in with their iTunes reviews. I've seen those posts, and we've already filled the five people that we bribed with this. David and Dennis, if you didn't hear, we were talking about what is it? It was a backlog related. What was last week's multiplayer? Oh, trade-in stuff. I talked about how I don't trade stuff in, even though I ought to. And I was like, well, I've got all these games that are redundant because I own them on Steam. Why don't I like bribe people to leave us a review? Not a good review, but just kind of like, hey, this is a contest. I'm shipping out three, and then Ben is shipping out two of them to people who write in reviews. And people responded. And the twist is, at least the ones that I'm sending out, I've written all over them, so I haven't just signed it like I said I would. Which is a singular, like, just signing it would be an act of like crazy intolerable egotism, but like me writing tips for Spec Ops the Line.
Nice. Wait, I feel like what tip can you possibly give other than like sort of pseudo, like, the only way to win is not to play.
Well, I don't want to spoil it because I do not want the person who is getting that to I want them to really experience the way that I've set up this maze for them with the text on it. Yeah,
nice.
So thanks everybody. Something new on the network that I'm trying for a little while, I'm not going to commit to doing it forever, is duckfeed.tv/news. I'm trying to do a weekly update with not just the, you know, like a one sentence summary of the shows and episodes that have released that week, but also like new things that are happening. That's going out over the Patreon page. I'm toying with the idea of doing a like an email list, but that will go out to a lot of Patreon people as well, and I kind of want that to just be like a one source kind of thing. But
which, if you're listening to this and not a Patreon, like, there's so much cool stuff you're missing out on. So the group is getting bigger every day, and yeah, we'd love to have you as a part of it.
Let me look at this just to kind of like highlight it. We're approaching 300 people in the Slack channel. Which makes it sound like it is way too big and untenable, and how do you find anything? Like, everything has been additive. Like, people have been good, people have been cool, and it's a nice place to be. So
yeah.
Yep. Can I share a personal note? Yes. Like, I was watching one of my coworkers play The Witness, like, on Twitch or whatever, and, like, ran into, like, some of the people that follow him or whatever are, like, mean and stuff, and it's like, oh, I've never had that experience with anybody on the Duckfeed Network, so yeah. Good on everyone for being cool.
We are incredibly fortunate, and I'm grateful every day.
Mm-hmm. We are very thankful for Duckfeed Black Ops that takes care of those sorts of things.
Oh yeah, but you know, there's the usual stuff, the Facebook, the iTunes, and just plain old telling some friends and coming back. Like, that's at the end, that is one of the best things you can do. So I have been Cole Ross at Cole Ross on Twitter.
I have been Dennis Furia at D Furia on Twitter.
I've been David Mysmith at Mysmith777 on Twitter.
I have been and will continue to be Ben Merkel at Merkelizer on Twitter.
Yeah, and stick around for some titles. All right, does anybody have ones they want to throw onto the list?
I actually have several.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I have Malfeasance or Other Big Words. Advanced Scarification Machine, although that was off air.
I'm sorry, that doesn't count.
Yeah. It's Just a Dog.
I have that too. The second dog is spelled with two G's, as I do.
I did D-A-W-G.
Yeah.
And then Campfire Watch.
Let's see here. Any others?
I have Shadowgate and Seventh Ceiling.
like ceiling, like the roof above you, or
I have both written down. So ceiling as a verb and ceiling as a noun.
Okay. To be fair, that was, you know, a direct reference. I mean,
Okay, David, how about you?
I did not have anything, although I really need to play Shadowgate.
Shadowgate's good. Let's see here. So I've got two that were not listed. I'm Losing Right Now. And Time Storm. And Time Storm is all one word.
What was the context for I'm losing right now?
Talking about how it does it, like,
you can do anything nothing, if you don't try to win.
Exactly. I'm losing right now. I think that one loses something without the intonation.
Sure. I like Time Storm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like Time Storm just for, you know, the common theme.
Mm-hmm. I like Time Storm as well. It's just a dog is pretty good, but we've had a lot of titles with dog in it.
I like malfeasance and other big words.
Malfeasance or.
But yeah, the quote was malfeasance or. The extended quote was no malfeasance or other big words involved, which that felt a little long, so I shortened it. But
okay, I'm going to disqualify Campfire Watch because we didn't really talk about Firewatch, and I imagine next week is going to be a bigger discussion of that.
Mm-hmm. I say let's not make it hard. I think Time Storm stands out.
Yeah, I like Time Storm as well.
Right.
All right.
Yeah. That works.
Cool.